might as well stay where you are. We'll figure it out. 16.2274 Netlist versus SanDisk. Sorry about that. Is that okay with you? Well, you'll figure it out. We'll keep it straight. Particularly with the cross appeal, it's a little confusing. We'll try to do our best.
Now, are you sure you're supposed to be there?
Yes. I have to stop and think, but yes, I do. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. This case demonstrates the need to protect the due process and procedural rights of patent owners where an IPR petitioner makes new arguments and factual representations regarding the prior art for the first time at oral argument. And it also demonstrates the danger of allowing the board to fill in the gaps in the references. And time permitting and subject to your questions, I'd like to address four primary points. Two with respect to each reference, and first with respect to the Averbouche reference. Netlist was denied its procedural rights because SanDisk failed to timely disclose its theory that there's a corner case where the sequencers produce address signals that can pass through the address generation unit without transformation or modification.
Let me ask you.
Yes.
Specifics. On page 53 of the blue brief, Netlist argues SanDisk has failed to show an inherent anticipation by Averbouche. I'm putting ellipses in here. There has been no showing how Averbouche's memory interface with its associated address generation unit can necessarily pass through untransformed, unmodified address signals and yet still provide the peculiarities required by the alleged devices. And then you reference your prior argument above that. And I wrote a marginal note there saying this is interesting and good-looking argument, except I don't see any evidence above that actually supports the position. What's your evidence for that?
Well, the position is essentially, Your Honor, that there's no disclosure of a pass-through. And to say that it would have to necessarily be there, they're pointing to the words as needed, to essentially mean that it must necessarily pass through. And the language doesn't support it. You'd have to interpret
it. It's not must necessarily, it's can necessarily pass.
Can, yes. Very good, Your Honor. You're correct. Can pass through in some corner case. And the evidence doesn't show that at all. And just to highlight that,
yeah.
Averbouche expressly at paragraph 6 says that the memory may have different bit densities, access speeds, addressing requirements, access protocols, and other particularities. That's Appendix 1036. Now, how do those particularities of the memory interface get satisfied? Well, let's look at the words as needed in context, because I think we probably all agree that that's how it should be viewed. We have a three-tier architecture in Averbouche, a BIST, which at paragraph 8 of 1036 says that the BIS provides only generalized commands. It's a generic command that communicates with Tier 2, the sequencer. And the Tier 2 sequencer is said to have very limited control, and it has specific reference to putting a common clock domain between the sequencer and one or more memory modules.
Let me ask you this. Looking at figure 6,
yes.
Is 42, the address generation unit, used to transform or modify address signals from the sequencer at 8A?
I believe so.
Okay. How?
So we have this the second tier, the sequencer, which is said to have only limited control of the application, and it talks about a common clock domain. And then we have an express teaching For Tier 3, the memory interfaces, you can find that at paragraph 11 at appendix 1036, which says they're designed in accordance with the particular signal interface requirements and physical characteristics of the respective one of the memory modules. So we don't have to speculate that there might be a pass-through. The teaching is you have a generic signal, you have very limited additional control for the sequencer. Primarily it says for common clock domain. And then you have all of this express teaching from paragraph 11 that says the memory interface is where all the particular requirements for the memory are handled and generated. It's the bottom tier. There's no teaching that the sequencer can have a signal that can pass through in a form that's based on the particular physical characteristics of the memory module. It's not there. And it's not, I just took you through the context of Averbuch to show why it's not there, but it's also, Averbuch doesn't use the words only if needed. He says as needed, and the context of Averbuch is that there's a transformation, is made as needed, which is in a way necessary to achieve the goal.
Is that transformation at 42?
Forgive me.
That's the generator.
Yeah, the 42 is the, if that's the AGU, the address generation unit, yes, that's what the specification teaches. That's where the transformation is. That's where all the particular requirements are handled.
Where does it say that? In what paragraph?
I took you through the context of as needed, Your Honor, but 42 says that the address generation unit, I'm sorry, the specification teaches that the address generation unit is what generates the address and control signals to be used by the memory devices. And the specification teaches that there are two different generation units, one for addresses and one for data, and that the specification never equates them. And I'll tell you that I wanted to point out, and we did in our brief, that the board relied upon paragraph 56 of Averbuch, which concerns the data generation unit and not the address generation unit. But Averbuch teaches that it has two distinct units, and they're separate and distinct. And there's no block diagram for the address generation unit, but there is a block diagram for the data generation unit. And you'll see that the block diagram has these XOR gates, which provide the logic for the data generation unit, which is very detailed and specific. But and that's figure 7, by the way, of Averbuch, but there is no such block diagram for the address generation unit, and it has distinct purposes. It has different inputs. It has different outputs. There's just no basis whatsoever to assume that the address generation unit has the same structure, function, or operation as the data generation unit. They're two distinct blocks, and the board, frankly, completely overlooked that because they cited the data generation unit as evidence of how the address generation unit operates. But it's just not...
Let me take you over to Wang.
Yes.
With respect to the Group B arguments, Netlist accused the PTAB of improperly burden shifting. But the PTAB addressed both parties' arguments and evidence and concluded that SanDisk proved unpatentability by a preponderance of the evidence. Are you still standing by that burden shifting?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'll tell you, and I thought we made it clear in our brief, and forgive me if we didn't, but the board only looked at the data writing functionality of the Huang memory interface, and it just ignored the testimony and evidence regarding the reading and shifting functionality of Huang's transparent interface, and it's clear Huang is black and white on this. At appendix 1078, the test interface can read each word and then shift the entire word bit by bit for testing. So it has a read operation and a shift operation. And we tried to take you through figure 4 of Wang, which is the redundant shift operation. And it might be a little bit complicated, but I'll try to revisit that. Figure 4 of Huang shows you have a memory A and a memory B, and then you have a 4-bit word width in memory A and a 6-bit word width in memory B, and those are read into the memory interface. And you see the word latch, And while memory B has 6 bits, they all are read into the memory B interface, but the memory A interface, because it operates on a common control line, has to shift 2 extra times with redundant bits. And so the memory B interface has a read and shift operation that is influenced by the word width and memory B by the operation of the memory interface for memory B. And so the operation of one transparent interface is influenced, i.e. forced to continue shifting, by the operation of the other Huang interface. And you won't find this in the board's decision. We put it in our brief. We cited it out. We argued it. We put the declaration evidence from our Dr. Seachin, who walked through it. And the board, for its part, stopped with the read functionality and the board only considered the writing functionality and didn't consider the read and shift functionality of the memory interface. And they stopped there, and then they expressly said that netlist, you haven't shown how the memory interfaces are operable independently. And that was an improper burden shift.
But that was right after they said Sandisk met its burden. I mean, this sounds like opinion writing issues. The board is allowed to reject your arguments by saying they're insufficient without being accused of burden shifting.
Well, if they did that, Your Honor, then they ignored the evidence that directly refutes the position that the conclusion they reached.
Well, they disagreed with you.
Pardon me?
Well, they disagreed with you.
They disagreed, but I because I didn't acknowledge it, I can only...
They don't have to acknowledge it, though.
Okay.
I mean, if you think that they made an error and their decision lacks substantial evidence because they didn't address this argument specifically, then you argue that. I mean, to argue that they're burden shifting because in one sentence they say they don't agree with your argument is a bit too much.
Well, fair enough, Your Honor. Then I think point taken, but it doesn't change the result. The result is that the board didn't consider the evidence and argument that showed that one memory interface is influenced by the operation of another. And so whether you call it a burden shift or you take that language out...
Well, you can't say they didn't consider it. They may have just disagreed with you. You can say that they were wrong and that substantial evidence doesn't support their decision, but it's not that they didn't consider it.
Okay, well, maybe it's best said that the board's decision is not supported by substantial evidence.
I mean, this is a big deal, and this is not the first time I've heard arguments that the board is shifting burdens because they use a sentence saying that the patentee has not demonstrated the validity of its argument, but they've otherwise said the petitioner has met its burden. And it's attempting to transform a substantial evidence question into a procedural legal error. And that's improper. You can argue substantial evidence, but taking one sentence out of context when they rejected your argument is not a legal error.
And our view was we couldn't tell that they considered the issue and they didn't rule on it expressly. I'm into my rebuttal time, if I may reserve.
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Netlist's manufactured procedural argument for the Averbouche grounds is both illusory and irrelevant. Under the uncontested claim construction, there can be little debate that Averbouche's sequencer generates an address and control signal for testing the memory. That's the best address and control signal.
Clarify something for me. Netlist argues, at least at page 25 of its brief, but several times, that it was only an oral argument that Sandisk alleged that Averbouche teaches the address could pass through. And in the red brief, Sandisk responds that we did it at least five separate times and cites to various points in the PTAB preceding the petition, expert declarations and reply and so on, and saying they're a clear notice of the pass-through argument. How do the parties have such totally contradicting views? I mean, it's almost a black and white thing. And
I can't speak to how why Netlist has such a contradictory view, but the issue as it crystallized post-institution really was whether the operation of Averbooz's address generation unit somehow removed what the sequencer unambiguously does from the scope of the control module, which is simply produce that. So as that issue developed over the course of post-institution, and I guess perhaps it's best to just go straight to the record, if you look at the reply, at page, this is at appendix 666. So, actually, let me back up, because both the petition and the board's institution decision said that the sequencer, acknowledged that the operation of the address generation unit operates as needed when it translates what the sequencer has generated, which is a BIST address and control signal, a control signal for testing a memory device, and laid the evidentiary foundation for this dispute over how the address generation unit, you know, what it actually does. And in the reply, and this is at appendix 666, we state that up at the top that there's no dispute that the sequencer produces the BIST address control signal. This is the second and third line. And then down below in the next paragraph, we say that the actual addressing information produced by the sequencer and the address generation unit 42, and the address generation unit 42 merely applies the received addressing information to a given physical memory configuration, row column configuration. We cite to Alpert's declaration, where he again cites to the as needed language for the address generation unit. That's at paragraph 49, and that's at appendix 1403.
Mr. Wimbiscus?
I'm sorry?
Mr. Wimbiscus? Is it?
No, right.
What? Oh, I'm sorry.
Me? Sorry. Yeah.
I'm getting it. So, right. Okay.
You switched sides.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I knew it was going to get me. So you just demonstrated the importance of the comma in the English language when you read that and you missed the comma. And, of course, the comma changed the entire meaning of that paragraph. I'm just pointing that out for grammarians in the audience.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So
for my clerks.
So lest there be any doubt that Netlist understood the argument it was making, if you go to the deposition where they deposed Dr. Albert on this very issue, and this is at appendix 2241 through 2243, this is where the actual articulation of as needed shows up for the first time in the record, was when they were deposing Dr. Alpert. And in response to a series of six or seven questions, maybe more, about what is happening at the address generation unit, Dr. Alpert responds after a number of questions. He says, well, I was going to say it might not. It's according to the, this is at appendix 2242. It's according to the physical characteristics of the memory module. It's possible that the address and control can just pass straight through depending on what might be required to map the patterns to the row and column organization. So it's only in response to their questioning on this particular issue that the pass-through comes out. It wasn't a new theory that was sprung upon Netlist, and certainly not at the oral hearing. And when it came to the oral hearing, as the petitioner, SanDisk went first, Netlist goes second, Netlist stood up, and they made a lot of arguments in the oral hearing about they have new counsel, and they made a new argument on this, and a new argument on that, and a new argument here. They didn't call out this pass-through theory specifically as a new argument when they had the opportunity to do it at the oral hearing, and the board didn't view it as a new argument either. They didn't like the answer, I think, that they got when they deposed Dr. Alpert, but this was not a new argument that SanDisk sprung on them right at the end. So the issue as it crystallized for the Averbouch grounds anyway was the impact of the data generation unit. Now I want to address the inherent anticipation argument, Judge Wallach, that you raised earlier. There is substantial evidence in the record supporting the board's factual determination on how the address generation unit operates. And if we could turn to Averbouch, starting at paragraph 11.
Do you have a page for us?
I do. That's at appendix 1036. Mr. Wimbiska cited to paragraph 11, but in the middle of paragraph 11 at 1036, it says each memory interface receives memory operations from a controlling sequencer and translates as needed, including associated address. And the next sentence, for example, a memory interface may...
Wait a minute. You just read that sentence, each memory interface. Where does it say as needed in that sentence?
It does.
Just translates memory operations, including associated address.
Oh, you just left out the middle part.
Yeah, as needed.
Just be careful.
I'm sorry.
It sounded like... You. That's okay. Keep going.
No, I'm sorry.
That's why when I quote from briefs, I say there's an ellipsis in there.
Right. So what I was driving at was the next sentence where it says, for example, a memory interface may translate addresses supplied by a controlling sequencer, and the memory interface may translate the data. Perhaps the most compelling substantial evidence in the board cited to this, not just cited to it, but reproduced this section in both the institution decision and the final written decision, is if you look at paragraph 48 of Averbouch, about halfway down that paragraph, it says, when electronic device 2 is operating in the BIST mode, however, the BIST enable signal causes the multiplexers, 45 and 46, to select the BIST address control signals and the test data provided by the respective higher level sequencer. If we look to figure 6 and we see what's happening there, which is at appendix 1030, it says that multiplexer 46 selects the BIST address control signal. And it's the multiplexer 46 that sits right in front of the line going out to the memory module. So the multiplexer selects the BIST address control signal. And then finally, with respect to the complaint about the data generation, the board relying on the data generation unit, the language as needed appears for both the address generation unit and the data generation unit. The board looked, and because the data generation unit provides an actual example of what as needed means, the board turned to that. And that's spelled out in paragraph 56 in Averbouch at 1040, where it says there, and I think there's no dispute, that the data generation unit can pass the data through with no transformation or translation. So that's an example in the specification that the board relied on to show what as needed means.
Can you, before your time runs out, can you turn to the Wang?
Yes.
And because it's a little confusing to me. I guess we've been looking at figure 4 for Wang, and your friend talks about the memory interface. And so can you just, using these diagrams, respond to what he said? I assume you disagree with his analysis.
Yeah, I think to set the stage for that analysis and how the board viewed it, it's important to look at the 434 patent first at the top of column 8. This is at appendix 289, where it says that each data handler is operable independently. This is where the patentee describes what operable independently means. And it says, starting at the line 3 of column 8, says, for example, each data handler is configured to write...
What, where are you?
I'm at appendix 289 at column 8 of the 434 patent, where the patentee explains what operable independently is.
Right.
So at column 8, line 3, it says, for example, and this is an example of operable independently, it says each data handler is configured to write to and or read from the corresponding plurality of data ports of one or more memory devices without being in communication, presumably with any of the other data handlers or other data ports of the memory devices. As such, each data handler can be used to generate independent, to generally independently test a portion of the memory space of the memory module. So that's the patentee's example of what operable independently means. If we turn back to appendix 1079, Judge Prost, where we're looking at Huang, you can see figure 2 right there. There's no indication that any of the individual transparent memory interfaces are communicating with each other. And in the second, or actually the first full paragraph on appendix 1089, it explains that, however, for transparent BIST, it is preferred to have the test interface generate test patterns locally.
Wait, you're at 1079, not 1089?
I'm sorry if I said 1089. I'm at 1079.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. So that's describing Huang's figure 2. And in the first full paragraph, second sentence, it says, however, for transparent BIST, it is preferred to have the test interface generate test patterns locally to avoid test data routing from test controller to each memory array. So we have each transparent memory interface corresponds to a particular memory module, generates the data locally, and there's no evidence in Huang that they communicate with each other while they are doing that. Another characteristic of operable independently from column 8 is that the data handlers are generally modular. And again, at appendix 1079 in figure 2, you see the transparent memory interfaces are generally modular. So the board really just took the characteristics of operable independently from the top of column 8 in the 434 patent and applied that to the Huang reference and made a determination that they operate independently. I see that I have about a minute left. I know that there is a cross appeal. I want to make sure I give the panel the opportunity to ask questions with respect to the cross appeal. Otherwise, I'm happy to cede the remaining of my time.
Can Sandisk, okay. Just on the cross bill. Sandisk argues that even though its petitions were unsupported with respect to Huang alone, such error was, quote, washed clean by the institution decision, and it should have been allowed to submit new evidence post-institution as part of its replies. Cite me to a case that extends this exception to allowing a petitioner to submit new evidence post-institution to supplement a ground raised in its petition.
I don't have a case off of the top of my head for that. The Administrative Procedures Act, I think, stands for the proposition that if the board is going to institute a new ground that's not in the petition, that the petitioner is allowed to support that new ground.
I am quite certain that if there was a case, you'd have it on the top of your head. So, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, a few quick points. First of all, in response to what counsel had just said, the Elpert deposition testimony was never made part of the petition or the reply. The theory was never adopted. There was nothing to move, to strike. There was nothing to respond to. We had just heard a lot of testimony that the board was about whether the Huang data handlers communicate with each other, but that's not the claim construction. That it, claim construction is without influence or control by another. And I walked it through why one influences the control of another. So turning then to the cross appeal, there is no case that allows counsel to sit back until the reply to bring in evidence for the first time that was necessary to establish a prima facie case. It's not there, and the board basically said as much. We have rules. Our rules are that the petition must have a detailed explanation of the significance of the evidence.
Doesn't this depend on the board's conclusion that the ground it instituted on was raised in their petition, that they did raise an alternative?
Yeah, and let me address that briefly.
Well, just let me finish. I mean, if that's the case, then they don't have an argument because that's the thing they raised in their petition. They should support it then. If the board did raise an entirely new ground for rejection, certainly they're allowed to present evidence to respond to that new ground for rejection. They aren't required to anticipate the board's entirely new ground.
Yeah, a couple points to that, Your Honor. First, the board did make it clear that its decision to review on Huang alone was based solely on evidence expressly cited by the petitioner in its petition. And it did go on to say that there are procedural safeguards, and this court said, and Belden versus Birktech, you have to take advantage of your procedural safeguards, and those include not only moving for rehearing or moving to withdraw the additional ground that you had disagree with, but most importantly, moving to supplement to provide supplemental information in support of the instituted ground. And the board made it clear, and that's what the rule expressly allows you to do. There's no rule that says I can sit back and wait till my reply, and for good reason, because that would really sandbag and disrupt the whole process. But the rules are clear.
So your view is if they had thought that it was a new ground, they should have taken steps before the reply to get their information in.
Absolutely, and that was the reasoning in part from the board. The board said we have these procedural safeguards. You have the right to put in supplemental evidence, and I thought one last point, if I may jump to the end, with respect to Huang and the reference to CERN, there is no explanation of any alleged common knowledge as a basis for CERN or in the petition. So the case law they cited about common knowledge doesn't apply. And the reference to a data handler, data handlers are to generate, modify, and transform. But CERN was a data buffer, and a data buffer doesn't generate, modify, or transform. So there was no explanation as to any relevance. They need to tie any alleged the significance of the common knowledge, if they allege that it was there, they need to tie it to an adequate explanation. And you can find that in the Ariosa Diagnostics case that they cited in their brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
1 minute rebuttal just on the cross appeal, as you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the cross appeal, the rules that the board has implemented, I don't think were intended to cover this situation where the board institutes on a new ground, first of all. Second of all, we didn't disagree with the board.
Your argument depends on the fact that this is a new ground. If we agree with the board that this wasn't a new ground, you're done on the cross appeal, right?
That's right. I don't think there really can be any dispute that the petition did not raise Huang alone. Our expert may have said
there can be a lot of dispute the way you worded your petition. But even if it is a new ground, why didn't you ask for to supplement the record or the like before your reply?
Well, So first, I don't think we felt that the record needed to be supplemented because this trivial implementation is something that...
Well, if it didn't need to be supplemented, then why did you try to put in new evidence with your reply?
Well, so the submission of supplemental information in the rules, the board, in our experience practicing before the board, routinely denies those requests. They're typically granted for instances where a patent owner makes a challenge to whether or not a reference is a printed publication or something like that. That's typically the scenario where the board allows the submission of supplemental evidence. But you know, for these trivial implementation details, it wasn't a matter of putting evidence into the record. It was a matter of arguments. So what it was a matter of saying that this is a trivial implementation detail. We did not need to rely on CERN. CERN shows this unambiguously. The evidence was sufficient in the record, you know, to go forward. We didn't have an issue with the board's institution decision.
Okay. Time's up.
Thank you.
We thank both sides. The case is submitted.